Morning Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 4, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Final results of South Africa's local government elections are expected today, Thursday.
Their support is disintegrating. It looks as if they may well get below 50% of the vote. And if more proof of this is the fact that for the first time, the Democratic Alliance has won some municipalities in KwaZulu-Natal.
Kenya orders the immediate closure of its border with Ethiopia. Why are Liberian business people rejecting the U.S. dollar? Guinea-Bissau's last parliamentary session of the year opens today, Thursday. Sierra Leone's education minister will join us to discuss banning corporal punishment in schools. And the death toll rises to 22 from Monday's Nigeria building collapse.
We have recommended the building code is there, and we have said 21 years jail, but nobody has been jailed. It has all been media hype. Noise, noise, noise.
And a cholera outbreak in Cameroon ahead of the African Football Cup of Nations. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Final results for Monday's South Africa local government election are expected to be announced today, Thursday. There have been speculations that the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, which has ruled South Africa for 27 years, may fall below 50% of the total vote tally for the first time amid continuing corruption allegations and poor service delivery in the country's major metropolitan areas. Sheila Kamere is a former member of parliament for South Africa. Africa's main opposition Democratic Alliance Party. She says her party has made some gains in some traditional ANC strongholds.
It's been quite an interesting election in the sense that we're holding up very well in the Western Cape. We're doing very well in Cape Town. You know, Cape Town's our flagship city that we run. And we're at the moment standing at, I think it's 61% of the vote. They haven't finished counting. I think they're around 70% of the vote counted.
As you said, you did very well in some areas. What message did you take to the voters?
The message that we took to voters was the city works when the DA is in charge. And an example of this being a very successful message was the Midvaal municipality in Gauteng province, which is the province that has Johannesburg, you know, our biggest city in it. And it's called Midvaal, a municipality quite south of Johannesburg. And it was in DA hands. It was the only one. And I think we barely won it, and we held on to it for 5 years. And this time, we won it with 70% of the vote. So people were convinced that, you know, if the DA runs things, the city services really work. And I think that was our message. That we're not like the ANC, we're not corrupt, and we don't let everything disintegrate and, you know, having sewage all over the streets and the water not working and the lights out and so on. And the message of our mayoral candidate in Cape Town, who's a very young man of 34, and he's been a member of parliament since he was 24, but he's now the mayor-elect of Cape Town, was that we're going to do everything in our power to disengage from Eskom, so that we don't have load shedding, so we keep the lights on in Cape Town as well.
The African National Congress has had support from black South Africans. How did you reach out to the...
Their support is disintegrating. It looks as if they may well get below 50% of the vote. And as the black Africans are a huge majority in this country, you can see how their support is disintegrating. And if more proof of this is the fact that for the first time, the Democratic Alliance has won some municipalities in KwaZulu-Natal, which is a province where it's a huge proportion, a huge black majority, mostly of the Zulu group. And we're winning municipalities there. So that is an extraordinary development. So it shows we're getting a lot more black support.
And what does that mean for your party?
It means that we're going to have many more city council members, councillors, and we're going to control more municipalities.
This could be, what, a blueprint, looking forward to perhaps presidential election?
Well, it's some years off, you know. I think we want to consolidate our position with local government at the moment. These municipal results indicate that we will still hold on to this province in the next general election. As I say, it's a good indicator that we'll carry on controlling the Western Cape.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Very nice speaking with you, too.
Sheila Kamari is a former member of parliament for South Africa's main opposition Democratic Alliance Party. Kenya has ordered the immediate closure of its border with Ethiopia due to a deteriorating security situation in Ethiopia. In a statement, the Kenya National Police Service expressed concern over the recent unfolding events in Ethiopia that the police said could threaten Kenya's national security as well as the security of other East African nations. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, experts said the war in Ethiopia can only be solved politically, not militarily.
Thousands of Ethiopians have been flocking in Kenya through the Kenya-Ethiopia border since the war broke up in Ethiopia, and this has prompted the Kenyan government to order foreclosure of the border a day after Ethiopia declared a state of emergency. Police spokesperson Bruno Sioso, in a statement, said that Kenya may be adversely impacted by the consequences of the events. Security experts say if Ethiopia will continue to fight, neighboring countries will have a refugee crisis. Dr. Hassan Hanenje is a director of the Horn International Institute for Strategy Studies in Nairobi, Kenya. He also advises Kenya's Ministry of Interior, Defense and Foreign Affairs.
In case of the potential implosion of Ethiopia, there's a likelihood there are going to be hundreds of thousands, if not millions of refugees flocking into Kenya. That is going not only to impose heavy costs on Kenya at the time when Kenya is preparing for elections, but it's also going to cause a humanitarian situation for Kenya in which the region or the country may not be prepared to handle right now.
Ethiopia has already declared a state of emergency, sparking condemnation from the international community over gross violation of human rights. Kenya and Ethiopia share a large porous border linking a length of 861 kilometers that traverses Marsabit, Turkana, Wajir and Mandera counties on the side of Kenya, while Borana and Dawa zones on the Ethiopian side. These interregional and cross-border movements oftentimes lead to conflict over water and pasture. Dr. Hassan says, however much Kenya is defending its territory, the war in Ethiopia can only be solved politically.
There is no military solution to this. This is an essentially political conflict that will have to be resolved politically. Neither the government nor TPLF can enjoy the superiority to be able to actually win the conflict militarily and then secure Ethiopia as a whole.
The police spokesman, Mr. Sioso, said that the police have intensified security and vigilance along the Kenyan borders and in their critical areas. Kenya is worried that the instability in Ethiopia may lead to flooding of foreigners into the country. The police have already advised Kenyan citizens to be vigilant and report undocumented aliens and unprocessed immigrants to the nearest police station. The chairperson of the African Union Commission, Musa Faki, has expressed deep concern over the escalation of military confrontation in Ethiopia. Faki has called on the parties to engage in dialogue and seek a peaceful solution in the interest of the country. On the other hand, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta, in a statement on Wednesday to Ethiopia, said that he is saddened by lack of meaningful dialogue between the protagonists and that lack of political goodwill is the reason behind the prolonged crisis. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
In Lagos, Nigeria, the death toll from the collapse of a building on Monday has risen to 22 as rescuers continue digging through the rubble in a search for survivors. Experts say the collapse was likely the result of poor construction and weak oversight and are worried that such catastrophes could happen again. Timothy Obiezu reports.
The search for survivors continued Wednesday at the site of the building collapse in Ikoyi, an upper-class area of Lagos State. So far, 9 survivors have been pulled out of the rubble and taken to hospitals. Scores more are reported missing. Search teams have found 22 bodies. On Tuesday, Lagos State Governor Babajide Sanwo-Olu visited the site and later suspended the state's building control head. Lagos State also launched an independent investigation into the collapse. But Festus Adebayo, founder of the Housing Development Advocacy Network, who visited the site, says authorities have been careless.
We are careless. We are just careless. We have recommended the building code is there And we have said 21 years jail, but nobody has been jailed. It has all been media hype. Noise, noise, noise.
Lagos state authorities halted the construction of the building in June for not meeting standard structural requirements. The local president of the Nigerian Institute of Architects, David Majekoduni, says the institute doesn't know if the problem was fixed before the workers were asked to return to the site.
You seal up a site. Definitely there are processes that you need to do before the site can be open. We can tell now whether the process went through.
Lagos authorities say they are assessing the possible impact of the collapse on nearby structures. Building collapses, unfortunately, are not uncommon in Lagos State, which has a population of 21 million people and thousands of high-rise structures. Adebayo says these catastrophes are not good for investment or business.
How do you think the whole world will be seeing us? How do you think, what impression they'll be having about our professionals? You will discover that a lot of people will no longer be going for high-rise building.
On Tuesday, rescuers received several phone calls from people trapped under the debris. No new calls came in Wednesday, and experts say that as the days go by, the chances of survival for trapped victims are getting slimmer. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 4th. The United States dollar is the world's most preferred currency of trade, but as Rita Jobwe reports from Monrovia, Liberian business people have recently been rejecting the U.S. dollar in favor of their local currency.
A scarcity of 5 and 10 Liberian dollar banknotes hit the Liberian market early this year, followed by the huge presence of mutilated Liberian dollar banknotes. The drastic scarcity has affected the U.S. to Liberian dollar exchange rate, dropping from 170 to 140 Liberian dollars for each U.S. dollar. Some analysts say the decline in the exchange rate shows appreciation of the Liberian dollar. But local business people say the drop in the exchange rate is making wholesalers to reject the U.S. dollar. Jeanette Vanny, who operates a provision shop in Kakata, one of Liberia's commercial hubs, says wholesalers are using the situation to exploit small businesses.
At the time, the rate was 170. And so buy chloride in a store for $5. They got it $5 a gallon. But when I went to buy the chloride the last time, I get the U.S., they tell me to put $100 on the U.S. So it was somehow shocking.
Gina says she appreciates the low exchange rate in the country, but she also wants the prices of goods to return to normal.
Saying they trying the rate is down, let it try to regulate prices in the store. Because the store people are not doing well for the citizen. The rate can be down, and when you go in the store, it's made prices high there.
Like Jeanette, Gladys Zomba is a retailer in Liberia's capital, Monrovia. She says the burden that comes with hike in prices of goods affects consumers directly.
Because we have control over the business with the local seller. It's only our $10, you take say $12 or $14. We not lose the same old buyer how we sell. Like the buyers, they will feed the waste.
The Ministry of Commerce released a statement last week instructing businesses to always display full price list of goods in both currencies to give buyers purchasing options. But Gladys says wholesalers are not adhering to the ministry's mandate.
People got the prices on the goods in the store. But if you get any money, then the price where you see in there, and they're going by. People get it on press. Let commerce leave the offices, let them get on the fee as a local business people, and then go to funnel or in the stores. Let them see for themselves.
Aaron Masakwe, a wholesaler in Monserrato County, says he is refusing the U.S. dollar out of fear he might lose on his goods. He says the drop in the exchange rate is artificial.
We are now multiplying each and every one of those rates by at least maybe $150 because the U.S. dollar rate can go. Anytime they bring maybe in the evening, the next day, maybe yeah, increase. So instead of 140, everyone multiply by the rate of maybe 150.
Representative Dixon Sibu is the chairperson of the House's Committee on Banking and Finance. He attributes the situation to the printing of a new family of Liberian dollar banknotes. But he says things will return to normal soon.
In this case, we've already passed a resolution touching the central bank. Please print new family of banknotes. Again, I know people are urging the fact that the rates have reduced and prices have not reduced. But again, over a period, it's going to get adjusted because once the rate is sustained over a particular period, market forces will push prices downward.
Meanwhile, the Ministry of Commerce has warned against price hiking and holding of commodities amid the scarcity of Liberian dollar on the market. The ministry says it will impose fines on business entities for violating regulations. Rita Jrabwe for VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
Guinea-Bissau opens its last parliamentary session of the year today, Thursday, and on the agenda is a contested constitutional revision. Dionisio Pereira, head of the youth division of the leading opposition party, the PAIGC, spoke to Ricky Strayak about the provisions and the likelihood of a new constitution being approved before the end of the year.
Right now, the commission, they are finishing the work with the people to show what is the new constitution is about. I think it was good because at this moment we have a kind of problems. We have president has its constitution and parliament has its constitutions. We are going to discuss about this session and maybe we are going to approve it. I'm not sure yet, but I think so. We are going to approve it.
Do you expect that in this parliamentary session before the end of the year, they will approve a new constitution? And what do you think that means for the country?
I think, yes, we are going to approve this new constitution. I think this is meaning so many things to the country because most of the problem that we have dealing in Guinea-Bissau is about our constitution. Some things is not clear in our constitution. Like I can give you some examples. The power of the president between prime minister is not clear. And with this new constitution, I think it's much clearer now what is the power of the president, what is the power of the prime minister, and then how we can solve, how we can manage these some problem that will come soon. But I think this constitution is going to solve most of the problem that Guinea-Bissau have been struggling with.
You know, I know, as you mentioned, the president has a version of constitutional revisions that he wants. The parliament has a different constitutional revision committee. In the past, it has been very difficult for the two sides to reach an agreement. How do you expect that to come about in this next session?
I think the president is not right, because according to the constitution that we have now, the parliament is the only institution that's available to approve the constitution, and it's not president. And I think this kind of thing is not good for Guinea-Bissau, is not good for, because the country will get in again in political instability.
That was Dionisio Pereira, head of the youth division of the PAIGC, the leading opposition party in Guinea-Bissau. He was speaking to Ricky Strayak from Bissau. Sierra Leone's education minister says his ministry is in the process of developing positive disciplinary measures for the nation's schools. This after the government a week ago banned corporal punishment in the nation's schools, and teachers have been wondering what method of punishment they should apply to unruly students. Minister David Sanger says the school environment should be a place for the development of young people and not a place to inflict more punishment on students, most of whom already come from homes where there is no emotional support.
The government of Sierra Leone, through a cabinet conclusion, has banned corporal punishment in schools and asked me and the Ministry of Basic and Senior Secondary Education with the Teaching Service Commission to introduce positive discipline methods. And my ministry has been working on developing these positive discipline methods with our partners, UNICEF, and several stakeholders, which will be ultimately used to train our teachers right across the country. Already in our engagements, in my visits to schools and in public discourse, we engage teachers and through the teacher union so that they know that this is our new position, and they've been quite supportive of it.
I guess the key question is that what is a teacher supposed to do with an unruly student or students in a classroom situation?
I mean, I think when we think about discipline and unruliness, we really have to understand what gets a child to behave a certain type of way. And the school as an environment is a place for growth, a place where we correct our mistakes, a place for support, a place for learning. Many of these kids come from homes where the heads of the families are not there, and they come from homes where discipline is not there already. So to further punish those kids at school when they don't have the kinds of support, emotional support at home, is really just inflicting more pain on those children.
Some people say that sometimes corporal punishment is necessary for the teachers to maintain some order. What do you say to that?
I think the idea that corporal punishment is required for teachers to maintain order, or that we all receive corporal punishment. I was beaten severally in primary school and through secondary school. I hated it. There were many teachers who I don't think I remember them, or I care to remember them, because of the way in which they inflicted violence on me. I did not become who I became by going to Harvard and receiving a PhD from MIT because of corporal punishment. It's actually in spite of corporal punishment. I think there are many people who drop out of school because of corporal punishment. We are traumatized by our teachers who beat us. We are traumatized by the ways in which our backs have marks on them still. But that's not why we became great students.
David Sengert is Sierra Leone's Minister of Education. He was speaking with us from the capital, Freetown. Cameroon health workers say they are fighting to stop a cholera outbreak that has claimed 12 lives within 3 days in two major cities of the Central African country. The cholera outbreak that has affected several hundred civilians is reported as Cameroon prepares to host the African Football Cup of Nations, AFCON, in about 2 months. Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's Health Minister Manaoda Malachi, in a release this week, said thousands of civilians in the capital city Yaoundé and Ekondo Titi, an English-speaking western town, are threatened by cholera. Cholera is an infectious and often fatal bacterial disease of the small intestine, typically contracted from infected water supplies and food. It causes severe vomiting and diarrhea, and can kill within hours if left untreated. Emos Komin Njikang is the medical doctor in charge of the Ekondo Titi Hospital. Njikang says he has dispatched health workers to the community to search for and transport cholera patients to the hospital. He spoke via telephone from Ekondo Titi.
4 more cases came in between yesterday and early this morning. We have made plans for transportation of new cases from the community to the health facility at Bamuso. We have also tried to increase personal hygiene and washing of whatever we consume. We're trying to tell them how to purify the waters before they drink.
The health ministry says several hundred patients have been rushed to hospitals in Yaoundé and Ekondo Titi. The government said it recorded at least 13 cholera-related deaths in the two towns since Monday. It is feared the outbreak may have claimed more lives in villages which lack health infrastructure. This week, the Ministry of Health said it dispatched several dozen health workers to ask civilians to improve hygiene and sanitation. The health workers say people who eat uncooked food and unwashed fruits or drink water that is not boiled risk being contaminated. The cholera outbreak is reported as Cameroon prepares to host the African Football Cup of Nations, AFCON, starting on January 9. Yaoundé, which will host teams from 8 African nations in the continental soccer event, has reported at least 100 cholera cases. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And that's it for this Thursday, November 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you will have a very good day.